the one is in phased. Of course, we know that. One is phased differently from the other. And let me drop it. The recommendation of length, not between the dipoles, that's variable on how you want your pattern to be. But the recommendation of the phasing line of each dipole, to your feed line, I can't seem to get a concrete answer in all the text that I've read. ARRL books, ARRL manuals, even Krauss's, I think it was a 1982 article that was in QST. Then nobody's really putting in, remember, the two dipoles are going to have a length, depending on how you want to have it, in spacing between each other, and they're going to have a length as an element for the frequency you want to work. I don't want to work multiple frequencies. A lot of articles give you to work a single frequency, but I'm not able to capture whether it's a 3/16 or a quarter or half, or even just say that if the elements are dropping. The elements are a quarter to a half wave spaced, it's going to give you two different bands or whatever, and that's okay. However, the feed between those, which is called a phasing line, one is crossed, one is straight, I'm getting very, very different recommendations on the length of that line, which is called a phasing line. Jake, I'm sure you know about Krauss.
Yeah, this two-element Yagi-like structure of Krauss been around for a long time, the WAJK beam antenna. If you Google the word WAJK beam antenna, you'll find a whole lot of articles, and one of those articles gives you a zillion pictures of various ways of building the 8JK. And I see that on many of them, the spacing between the forward dipole and the rear dipole is set as 1/8 wavelength on many of them. Between the forward dipole and the reverse and the back dipole, you've got the equivalent of twin lead, but the twin lead is reversed. In other words, you take the twin lead from the forward dipole, flip it 180 degrees before attaching it to the rear dipole, and then in the middle of that twin lead is where the transmission line is fed. So that's one of the popular ways of making the 8JK. The 8th wavelength of spacing gives you a very high amount of directivity, a rather good front-to-back ratio on the antenna, and wait a minute now, is that the one that's the bidirectional? The two arrows I see here suggest that that's the... No, that can't be. That can't be the bidirectional one, I don't think. Now I'm not sure. It looks to me like there's a lot of variations to the WAJK methods of construction. Let me drop this. Yeah, I see in some cases... No. Looks like it's always fed in the center of the so-called twin lead section, the phasing harness between the forward dipole and the rear dipole. It looks to me like that's usually fed in the center, in which case, is that going to be bidirectional? I think it is. I believe this thing is going to give you a figure eight pattern. Is that what you've seen so far in the literature you've read so far, George? KD2FIU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KD2FIU. Thank you, you're on the same page. What I'm working with here, it's not the spacing between the elements, it's the actual length of the phasing lines themselves. One is in phase, one is out of phase. And I'm finding the recommendations of the phasing lines are not consistent, because the phasing line itself, you got the feed point in the middle is going to give you bidirectional. If you start to shift that feed point towards either element, element, you're going to shift the direction of the antenna to be dominant in one direction. Let me drop. As you move away from the center, you will no longer be a pure bidirectional. You're going to more or less be in one direction if you go toward one of the dipoles, and your direction starts to change and that pattern broadens. But the length, it's not the spacing. The spacing can give you two bands, depending whether it's 1/8 to 1/4. Let's say you start with 10 meters. You could wind up, which spacing differential of a quarter and anywhere to a half wave of spacing between the two dipoles, you could wind up with 10 resonating on 15 and possibly resonating on 17 in an opposite mode, broadside versus end fire. Now, what I'm finding is that I cannot nail down how long the wire is in between that spacing. Nobody's coming up with it. WHJK only came up with a massive tuning structure of tubes and tromboning it, so to say, of shunting it. However, let me drop it. You're going to see somehow that it's not going to be perfectly straight. You don't run it straight across. It's going to have a droop in the middle before you hit that feed point. Those stubs, so to say, going to each dipole, I cannot nail down the formulas for that. KD2FRU, back to you, Dick.
Now, part of what's going on here, as I see it, George, is anybody who comes up with a formula is making an approximation of a formula. He's made a bunch of data as he swept it across a particular band, he plotted it, and then for a particular length and a particular spacing, he tried to come up with an equation that was a form-fitting equation that sort of matched the data. This is one of those situations where if you try to do a complete theoretical study, you'd be amazed how complicated this is, because the two dipoles definitely see each other. So the two dipoles, their electrical length, each of them, and their spacing is creating a mutual impedance between the dipoles. That's not very easy to pin down with an equation. Let me drop. And the phasing harness between the two, the changing of the length is going to do various things with various impedances. The various lengths is going to give you various bands where it works well. My recommendation is that you've got two choices here. You can make this a beautiful computer modeling study. Like, there are a number of computer modeling programs, EasyNEC among others. NEC stands for Numeric Electronic Code. I think it's what NEC stands for. Anyhow, there's a series of NEC modeling programs. There's also called YAGI Optimization, YO program. There's High Frequency Structure Simulator. There's a number of computer modeling programs where you tell the program the diameter of the dipole, the length of the dipoles, the spacing between the dipoles, and the length of your phasing harness and the impedance of your phasing harness, and it'll tell you at each frequency you care about what will be the exact voltage distribution, current distribution, antenna pattern, impedance. They'll tell you everything. Let me drop. So by choosing the right computer modeling program, and I think there's a pretty good computer modeling program that's included with the disk drive they give you, with the CD-ROM they give you with the latest issues of the ARRL antenna book, I think you can model it pretty well. That's one approach. And the other approach is to literally build the thing, because the dollars for the materials involved are not very great. And for you to actually build the thing in your backyard, set it up on a wooden ladder, and actually make measurements is another approach. If I was you, at first I would try to choose your favorite band and choose various ways of tuning it to give you good performance on your favorite band. If you try to make it a good impedance match, give it a good pattern, and a good broadband impedance match and a good pattern on all of your bands simultaneously of interest, I think you've made an overly constrained problem. I think you've made it too complicated. Choose your favorite band and try to optimize it for that particular band. Let me drop it. The structure of the WHJK kind of antenna is very general. All kinds of guys have built it and added their own twist to it. They've added their own individual personality by changing lengths, diameter, spacings, impedance of the phasing harness, length of the phasing harness. They've juggled all these parameters for whatever their favorite either impedance pattern or bandwidth or whatever. So I can see there's a whole lot of variations because each guy puts his own individual spin on it. And now you'd like to find out who's got the optimum design. That's a tough one. But with enough research, you'll either find it or derive it, in my opinion. Back to you, George. KD2FIU, wait for the four beeps. K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, Dick, thank you for focusing on my exact dilemma here. It's the length of the phasing harness. As it is fed in the middle, it's going to have its bidirectional, maybe 6.5 dBi, 4 dBd. Excellent. You build two of those. Let's say I'm focusing on one band. And I'm not going for the multi-band, which it can be made with extensive tuning. But I just cannot nail down the proper length for the phasing harness itself. Some are saying 3/16 wave for each leg. Some are saying 10th wave. Some are 20th wave for each leg. Of course, with Drew. But thank you for phasing on the fact that my dilemma is here, the phasing harness individual length itself from each dipole, not the overall length throughout the spacing. It would be each part of the phasing harness, up front or back or left or right, whatever you want to call it, but each little half piece during that spacing. And of course the spacing is going to permit you to work one or two bands, but the feed point on that phasing harness is going to also correct your directivity of whether it's going to be dominant in one direction. I'm trying to go recycle. Trying to go bi-directional, so I want my feed in the center. But the length of those phasing lines from the element, each dipole element, is what's really got me bogged down. And, I guess modeling or experimentation. Very interesting project, Dick. Over to you.
It appears to me that one of the popular spacing between the forward and reverse and rearward dipole is around an eighth wavelength. If the dipoles are spaced by an eighth wavelength, you don't stand a chance of making the phasing harness a tenth or a twentieth of a wavelength long. It ain't going to reach. So those numbers can't possibly work unless I misinterpreted. It may be talking about the spacing of the open wire feed, so to speak, the phasing harness itself. Yeah. You've got a lot of variables here. Diameter of dipoles, length of dipoles, spacing between the dipoles. The phasing harness can be made out of 450 ohm, 600 ohm, open wire line, large diameter, small diameter, big spacing, small spacing, long length, short length, fed in the middle, fed closer to one dipole than the other. You've got a lot of variables involved here. none of them are showstoppers. If you get it wrong, it's not going to suddenly explode. It's a beautiful experiment as paradise as I see it. And whether or not you want to favor the computer modeling approach or the physical empirical backyard experimenting approach, that's your choice. And maybe some mixture of the two. Let me drop. And once you know the claimed gain, 8 dB over isotropic, 6 dB over isotropic, whatever, that by the usual formula, gain is 4 pi A over lambda squared. Gain is a hard number, not decibels. And you can solve that for area. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. And once you know the area, you assume the area is sort of a circle. When you look from the front, it's a circular area. Knowing the area, and you know it's a circle, you can calculate the diameter of the circle. Once you know the diameter of the circle, and you want the upper, you're going to stack a pair of these antennas. I presume you're vertically stacking them. And your next question is going to be, how far apart should you stack them? And the answer where those two circles are just kissing each other or overlapping a little bit. You don't want a great big overlap, otherwise you're wasting potential gain. So you've got a lot of variables to play with here. This antenna is a tweaker's paradise, almost as much as a Yagi. In the case of a Yagi, you can adjust the length of every one of the directors, the spacing of every one of the directors, the diameter of every one of the directors, and so on. You got a lot, and either of these kinds of antennas, you got a lot of variables to play with. And somewhere in that morass of variables is your desired optimum. And I don't think you're going to find an article that gives you... Let me drop it. Maybe you will find. If you dig deep enough, you're going to find somebody who says, hey, I played with the WHJK. I experimented with it for 3 solid months. And this is the optimum that I came up with. And these are the dimensions that I used. You may find a guy who did that. And maybe you start off with that particular guy and you use his starting parameters as a good ballpark, and then maybe tweak a little bit beyond that for your particular desired perfection. So, you're going to be busy for a while, as I see it, George. I don't think there's a beautiful cookbook recipe on this particular one. And as you do your experiments, either, whether they're successful or not successful, in either case, please come back and tell us your progress and what you're finding along the way. This is a very famous antenna. It's been around since the 50s, and here we are 50, 60 years downrange, and there may not be a perfect recipe as to how to build one of these to optimize any one of those performances, like gain, pattern, front-to-back, bandwidth, number of bands, and so on. Oh, dear George, KD2FIU, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good. Thank you for picking it up and bringing it on the net over here. Like I said, I wanted to work at monoband. If it worked, the half multiple, meaning quarter wave, because they're half wave elements in full. If it were to work that, let's say I go for 10 and it works some on 20. Fine. Absolutely fine. I'm not going crazy for that. But I'm going to keep up researching on this because there's got to be some literature where those phasing lines where they leave that dipole and make its way to the center feed point in order to gain a dual polarity antenna with that amount of gain as WHJK had designed it in the late 30s. Quantum physics PhD, as he was. Whatever, you know. But interesting, I've read so much pointing to the success of that modeling driving... Let me drop it. Driving the design of so many antennas in the future. Aside from Yagi Uda, that this simplicity of phasing drove so many, many antenna designs. And to me, to have two of them, whether I'm stacking them or whether I'm placing them in the attic, or distances from each other, one east-west, one north-south, whatever. But thank you for bringing it up to me. And the point is, my only option is heavy experimentation right now.
You said dual polarity, and you confused me a little bit by that one, George. Under normal methods of mounting this antenna, it's a purely horizontally polarized antenna. You may have meant one aimed east-west and one aimed north-south. You want a dual directionality, and if you really want a dual polarity, you would set up one with horizontal polarization and one with vertical polarization. So, dual directionality, dual polarity, dual frequency bands. There's a lot of kinds of duals here. So when you said dual polarity, I'm a little bit confused. Back to you for any correction on that one, George. K2RIW.
K2RIW, KD2FIU. Yes, I meant dual direction. Bi-directional is the term. Sorry about that.
Okay, so you favor dual directionality, in other words, a front-to-back ratio of nearly 0 dB, and essentially a figure-8 pattern, which means you're probably going to be using your transmission line in the center of that phasing harness. And as you adjust the length of that phasing harness, you're going to get changes in the pattern, front-to-back, and performance, but it's not going to be a complete showstopper. It doesn't suddenly explode at some particular length. It's a slow, continuous change. And the various modeling programs, I'm pretty sure will show that to you. Good luck with that project. That's going to keep you off the streets for a while, as I see it, George. That's going to keep you busy. And you've got yourself an interesting challenge. But when you finally do come up with a set of parameters, set of measurements, spacings, that are ideal for you, it's time you publish an article on that. Because it looks to me like lots of people have tweaked with this antenna, but not many people have said that this is the performance you get when you build it this way. I think there's a real need for that kind of hard data. Over to you for any final, George. K2RIW.
Hey, good, Dick. And remember, it's not the distance or the spacing between each of the dipoles. That's not the issue. It's the length of each phasing line to meet that middle point. And that I'm going to have to work with. And yes, I will be in touch probably through somebody we both talk with. Very good. Very good. Thank you for spending the time with me on this. And I know what I'm going to work with. I'm probably going to build it with 300 ohm, 18 gauge. I'm going to start with that as an experiment, and I'll probably use a 16th continuous 300 ohm 16 gauge feeder before I go into a matching unit, which will be a 4-to-1. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. From there, I'll coming down at 75 ohms. And I might see the best at 1.4, 1.5 to 1 if I built it right. KD2FIU. Thank you, Dick.
Good luck with that project, George. I'm going to give another call to Joe and see if he has come back. WA2RYY. K2RIW. Go right ahead, Joe.
Dick, if you get a chance, I have a question. N2EO.
Looks like we've got a chance right now. Go right ahead, Joe. Rich, N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. I wonder what you know about a starboard curtain antenna. And do I have room for one? I think they have quite a bit of gain. And are they frequency sensitive?
Each of the Stober curtains that I have seen in the past are pretty massive structures. And if you're doing that on 2 meters, yes. If you're doing it on 40 meters, no. Is that approximately the kind of information you're looking for, Rich? Go ahead. K2LIW.
I think I was hoping I could do one for 40 in my backyard in the spring.
I doubt it. What the photographs I've seen of what's called Stober curtain would lead me to believe the answer is no. You don't have enough real estate. But there's a whole lot of articles on that subject. I recommend you do a web search, and you'll find out how big it is, for which of the bands, how many people have built it, how do they build it, what do they use for materials, and so on. So I would do some research on this. Stober curtain sounds to me like a homebrew antenna. I don't think I can open up a catalog and find a stock item on the shelf called Stober curtain. That's my guess. Maybe you're going to correct me on that one, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW.
Put input.
Okay, who's the other station? Is that you, Barry, on echoing?
George again, KD2FIU. AT&T, long distance with using them. You might find them in some very detailed text. AT&T was using them on the mid portion of HF in the late 1920s throughout the 1930s for long distance links.
And George, roughly how much real estate was involved? I'll bet you this is an antenna that was on multiple acres of property. Is that true?
You know, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I picked up on this. I joined with them in 71, and from there we were in microwave towers and different frequencies, but just learning about how the history of the long-distance link went through the early part of the 20th century, that was the antenna used, and it was used in the middle part of HF.
And Rich, you probably chose the word Stober curtain because it's known to be a high-gain antenna used in the dark ages of a very long range, you know, across the pond from the United States to Europe type antennas on the commercial radio circuits in, say, the 40s and 50s, maybe even the 60s, year-wise. So it's an antenna with a lot of gain potential. Therefore, it sounds very desirable. However, you're up against some very basic laws of physics. If 40 meters is your favorite band, and 40 meters, a full wavelength is 130 feet long, and now how much gain and how much directivity you're going to get out of any antenna you build, let me drop it, is purely a function of how much real estate you've invested in the antenna. If you want an antenna with a lot of directivity, in some particular direction, you want a lot of gain in some particular direction, you have to develop a number of wavelengths, not a quarter of a wavelength, I'm talking about 2, 3, 4, 5 wavelengths of antenna structure favoring that direction. If your wavelength is 130 feet and you want to have multiple wavelengths to have a lot of potential gain, potential directivity, you know, one of the simplest antennas that gives you a lot of gain with very little hardware is a Yagi. I don't have to tell you roughly how much real estate is occupied by a 3 or 4 element Yagi on 40 meters. The boom would be longer than the diagonal length of your property. So to wish for a whole lot of gain on 40 meters without investing in multiple wavelengths of real estate, beyond the laws of physics, and it can't be done. So you got to live with some of these restrictions, Rich. N2EO, until you go out and buy the 10-acre antenna farm. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. You know, Barry, N2MB, who's now visiting his son in South Carolina, his son Sam is N2LKH. And where he is in South Carolina, Barry told me there's a lot of woods there. He's got three kids. Once they get a little older, he can do it.
Okay, that does sound possible. And so, I thought you wanted to do this in your backyard in Massapequa, and I don't think it's practical. But if you find a way to do it, I'll eat some crow, if you know what I mean. Good luck with that project. Okay, we've called Joe twice, but call him one more time. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W. Are you back with us, Joe? K-2-R-I-W listening.
K-2-G-J-E.
K-2-G-J-E. Go right ahead, sir.
Good evening. Could I ask you a question on the gamma match?
If you've got a whole lot of money, yes, you can. Go right ahead. K-2-G-J-E, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay, thank you. I know how the gamma rod is set up, and basically we're feeding a dipole. I was just interested on the electrical and the mechanical connection to the boom on the dipole portion, over.
Probably the best answer I could give you on how to set up a gamma match is that a number of the very popular Cushcraft Yagi antennas are fed with gamma match. So we simply make a Chinese copy of the antennas being used by Cushcraft. You do a pretty good job of it. I think you're asking, is there a general formula for what percentage of the dipole length should the gamma match rod be? I don't know of anyone who has answered the question in that manner, Ed. K2GJE, K2RIW.
K2GJE. No, I was interested in the mechanical and electrical connection to the center of the dipole, not the gamma rod. Is the dipole one continuous rod insulated from the boom, or do you ground the center of the dipole that the gamma rod is feeding over?
The way a gamma match antenna dipole is fed, almost always, the dipole itself is one continuous rod, no gap in the center. The center usually is grounded to the boom if it's part of a Yagi. And when it comes to the coax cable that feeds the gamma match rod, the shield of the coax cable goes to that center of the dipole and the boom at the ground lead, and that's the shield of the transmission line. And the center conductor goes to the gamma match rod. That's the usual way it's deployed. So the rod itself is one continuous length. When you're using a T-match or a gamma match, you don't have to create any kind of a gap in the center of the dipole. I think that's what you're looking for, Ed. K2GJE, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2GJE, 100%, that was what I was looking for. And talking about investing in real estate, when I lived in Europe, I had a wave and a half on 20 meters, and I talked to the East Coast every night, over.
Yep. You can't get gain without real estate. You'd be amazed how many people have built micro-miniature antennas, and they think they're getting a whole lot of gain. And if you... Sometimes a micro-miniature antenna will give you a main lobe with a bunch of side lobes and not very good front-to-back ratio. But if you measure the beam width of the main lobe and you naively assume that that is dictating the gain for you, you can come up with some pretty crazy gain numbers that are not real. Real gain requires real estate. Was there a second person there who wanted to make a comment? Give me a call, letters, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2FRU, it's George. And that gamma match, my experience when I had a serial SD dipole just for a very short time, the construction of it was like an open air capacitor. And that was my impression of it at the time, for that gamma match tube being set up.
That's frequently the way it's done. Sometimes it's done with telescoping tubing with a sheet of Teflon between the two. Sometimes the center rod is suspended from the outer rod of the gamma match capacitor, very similar to the construction of heliax coax cable. There's various ways of doing it. But a variable capacitor in series with that rod cancels the inductance of the rod. And by adjusting that capacitor and adjusting the length of the gamma rod, you can come up with essentially a perfect impedance match on any dipole in any location, whether it's part of a Yagi or if it's out in free space. So it's a very handy structure. Some people don't like the gamma match rod because it's a non-symmetric feed. You're only feeding one half of the dipole. And the people who worry about that are worrying unnecessarily. Let me drop it. When you study a dipole-like structure, any of the books that will describe it to you will tell you it is a standing wave structure. That means that the energy you launch into that dipole by way of your transmission line and your transmitter does not immediately get radiated. It bounces back and forth 10 times on the dipole before it finally gets radiated. So the fact that you're feeding it non-symmetrically doesn't matter. The majority of the energy on that dipole is the previous 9 cycles that you've transmitted into that dipole. That energy has all accumulated, if you know what I mean. Very similar to what happens when you're pushing your son on a swing. If you wanted to do it completely symmetrically, when he's at the bottom of the swing going forward, you push him forward. When he comes back to the bottom and he's going backwards, you would pull him backwards. That would be a symmetric feed. You don't have to do that. You only keep pushing him forward on each time he hits the bottom going forward, and that's good enough. The majority of the energy of that child on the swing is the kinetic energy of his velocity at the bottom and the potential energy of his altitude when he's at the end of the swing motion, if you know what I mean. So, and unless you're Arnold Schwarzenegger, you don't give him full energy in one push. It takes 10 separate pushes before you build up the energy. Your dipole operates in a very similar manner. So, non-symmetric feed, don't worry about it. And with any further questions or comments, give me a call that is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, I think we've run out of questions for the time being. Time to go over to the space report. WS2N. Paul, what the... this is a very naive question. What's new with NASA and the European Space Agency and the Japanese Space Agency and the Chinese Space Agency and the French Space Agency and Kourou, South America? And let me think now. There's got to be other space agencies. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
This is WS2N. Yeah, there's a lot of them. There's so many of them. I think we tried to list them one time, but it lists too long. But there's a Canadian one, you know. I think we left out the Russian. And then there's like 20 countries that jumped on the European Space Agency list that's all involved with the space program. You go to Austria, Belgium, Czechoslovakia, Denmark, Finland, France, of course, is part of it. That's Kness, but they have their actual own agency. Germany, Greece, it's just in small countries, Luxembourg. But Luxembourg is a big company when it comes to satellites. You know, they must control 50 geosynchronous satellites out there. So one day we'll go through a list. And then there's the private companies. Let me drop it. We can't forget the private companies. There's so many of them. And there's all the time, but a couple of them drop out too. We just lost Firefly, and X-Corps is dropping their Lynx spacecraft. They're going to continue building a rocket engine, but, you know, not. Looks like the spacecraft is. They're going to cancel that. They, you know, it looks like they have financial problems. Who knows what else? But then more of them come on board. So we're looking for a good future probably in the next year or two, a couple of years after that. Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, everybody's talking about this one lady that just passed away that was involved with Star Wars. But there's another one that wasn't an actress named Vera Rubin. Vera Rubin. I bet you would know who it is, Dick. I'm gonna guess. You know who Vera Rubin is? Like, take a guess. Back to you.
I'm going to guess that she's one of the ladies doing some really good astronomy work back in the days when females were not being recognized. And she may have been the lady that discovered that galaxies are not rotating with the right angular velocity versus radius. That she, I think, may be the first person who recognized dark matter. Am I even close? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yes, you're right on the money, and it's good to find that somebody else knows that. Because, you know, so some of these people don't get the headlines. I've read about this one in astronomy books many years ago, and probably three or four books I have her being quoted as, you know, the one that got involved with the staring at the galaxies, looking at the spin of the galaxies and the relative spin, and something just wasn't right, and it led to dark matter, which to me is one of the biggest discoveries in all of astronomy and cosmology. So, yeah, we lost her at 88 years old. And then another astronaut we just lost, Pierce Sellers. He was, I believe, a three-time flyer on the space shuttles from NASA. So, Glenn, of course, we just lost. But then there's more guys coming on board, so goes around and around. I don't want to time this out. 1 second. WS. On the space station, Expedition 50 is up there right now, and there's a total of 6 people on board. And they are going to be doing a space walk on this Friday. And the two Americans. You have a woman and a man, Kimball, Shane Kimball, will be doing the EVA, and then as well as Peggy Whitson. She's been up there at least three different times to the space station, and they're going to be changing out these big adapter plates for batteries that were bought up recently on the Japanese cargo ship, the HTV, that's now presently docked to the space station. On board that, they had batteries, a big pallet. They on the Japanese pallet, they have a pressurized section and an unpressurized section. The unpressurized section is quite large, and you need a big robotic arm to take out this big pallet and on it are batteries, and there are 6 batteries, and these 6 batteries are going to replace 12 batteries that are presently on board the space station, and they've actually started work on it right now. They have the robotic arm with the Dextra robot on the end of that, loosening bolts that are holding down these batteries, and they're going to be removing them, 12 of them, and replacing them with these 6. And they're switching over from one type of batteries to the other. So,
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
There's a lot more flights that are going to be going up. You have six batteries now. You're going to bring up six more at a time. You know, these are thousands of pounds, you know, each flight. And they're all over the space station. And the ones that are there are getting old. They need to be replaced. And although they both have the same recharge cycles, I've read 20,000 cycles each. They go beyond that, but the ones that are on board have reached their end of life expectancy. It's supposed to be 10 years, and they get like 15 years now out of these things, but 10 years is the number that they're looking for. So should be interesting. We'll talk about that a lot if you want more, or probably next week after the EVA is taking place. Let me drop. Just to change topic for a second, Google Prize is still out there. $30 million total. So if you win the first prize, it's $20 million. And if you win the second prize, it's $10 million. But to do that, you need to send a spacecraft to the moon before the end of 2017. You need a contract. You don't have to go before that, but you do need a contract to get there with a company that's going to, or a country that's going to put you on board their rocket, so you can do that. And once you get to the moon, you have to land, and then you need to send HDTV back down to Earth. After doing that, your spacecraft needs to move, either fly or drive, 500 meters, and then do the same thing, send back more telemetry and HDTV, and that's how you win a prize. Now, over the last, I'd say about 3 or 4 years, this one company, Moon Express, an American company, was the only one that was pretty much looked like it was going to be the only one. But now there's five companies that are now giving it a shot to do it. They've actually got contracts with somebody to give them a ride to the moon.
Paul, when you say by 2017, does that mean you have to have a contract before 2017 begins or before 2017 ends? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, you need it before 17 ends. So, you know, if I get a contract, you know, December of the end of this year, and, you know, I get a launch scheduled sometime 6 months in, that, you know, in 2018, they said it's okay. So, you've got this, the Moon Express, of course, they've got a contract with Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is a company that's developing what they call the Electron Rocket. That's, it hasn't made its maiden flight yet, but they expect it to probably do that probably this month. They've got a contract with them. Now, SpaceL, they come out of Israel, has a contract with SpaceX to launch. Another company I never heard of is Synergy Moon, planning on launching on another rocket. Don't know much about that one. I know there's an Indian team, Indus, I-N-D-U-S, and they have a contract with the Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle. That's the PSLV. I've talked about them before. There are rockets that India launches from India, and they have a contract with them. And I believe it's a secondary payload. Let me drop it. And I believe it's the same for SpaceX, SpaceL. I think that's a secondary payload as well. So that should be interesting to see what happens there. Another topic, we always cover Blue Origin. Blue Origin came out with a very good website. They changed their website. and they have all the information about the new Shepard rocket that they're developing. They've launched and landed five different times with the new Shepard. They've launched on top of a spacecraft that will eventually be manned. One that they launched could have been manned, but it wasn't. And they've done it five times. They launched this rocket suborbital, and then the payload, which is the spacecraft, separates, comes down on parachute. Let me drop it. And then the booster comes back and lands. And this takes place out in West Texas. So their website is very good. You can see all the different parts. You look at the B-3 engine that they use. They're developing the BE-4 engine. And that's much larger, you know, probably six times larger than the BE-3. But they do have a couple of videos, not YouTube, videos from their website, so it's very well done. You can see their latest video, or you can go back to their gallery and watch any one of their last five launches. You can also see an animation of what it would be like to be one of the six paying astronauts that are on board that will probably take flight in 2018. And maybe a test flight with astronauts on board by the end of this year. So that should be pretty cool. Another company, private company, Virgin Galactic, they're developing the new space plane that will eventually have eight people on board. And again, suborbital. And they're coming out of the two-year lull that they've had because their first one, wing is supposed to really go on a 90 degree angle when it's coming back through the atmosphere, and the co-pilot accidentally pushed that button on when he shouldn't have, and that plane crashed 2 years ago. Space plane, I should call it a plane, it's really a space plane. And this is a duplicate of that, but they made some technical changes where that can't happen again. And now that made its second flight. It's a drop flight. It's not powered yet. The old one was got to the point where it had powered flights. And, you know, with their testing. And this one, it's just a drop test from their carrier. They have two pilots on board, and they landed successfully two times, so that's looking good. And maybe Virgin Galactic will be able to make some headway with that. Drop it. And that's pretty much it. A lot of things, of course, we've been missing for 2 weeks, but because of Christmas. But I'll try to catch up on some of the other things. One thing I want to go over next week would be getting water out of the atmosphere of Mars and come up with a system for that. So that should be it. But, you know, that's one of the stepping stones that NASA's developing to eventually conquer Mars. The battery topic I find to be most interesting this week because that will be taking place on Friday. They're replacing the old nickel hydrogen, and they're not nickel metal hydride batteries, but they're nickel hydrogen batteries. If you've seen these things, it's a pretty interesting design, but it's an old design, and they're now being replaced with lithium ion, and these are many hundreds of pounds each, and the International Space Station is covered with these things. So, we'll see. They're delivering 160 volts when the space station is not in the sun. So, they've been doing this every hour and a half since the year 2000 successfully. incredible, but it's time to change out the batteries. Back to you, Dick, for any comments, questions. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
Those massive solar arrays on the International Space Station, I keep forgetting the number. Is it around 120 kilowatts that they can generate, that pole? Is it in that neighborhood? Go ahead.
Yeah, I've seen on the NASA sites from 120 to 130. A lot of other places, I believe Wikipedia says 110, but I'm going to call it 120. Some people say it's enough power to power 50-some-odd homes if you have them here on Earth. The older magazines I used to read, before I even bothered with the NASA sites, I remember reading in the 40, they said 40 homes when it was being developed. So let's call them 120, like you said, 120 kilowatt output. It's 160 volts, and then they have DC to DC down converters to 120. Let me drop it.
Let me stop you right there, Paul. If that International Space Station 120 kilowatt solar array is running at 160 volts, 120 kilowatts at 160 volts is 750 amperes. To transmit that much current to a rotary joint, wow. I'm having trouble believing that the real solar cells are only producing 160 volts. 160 volts may be the battery charge after you've done a voltage conversion from the cells. But I'll bet you the cells are running a lot higher than 160 volts. 750 amps through that rotary joint. Boy, that wouldn't last very long, is my guess. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, well, yeah, they're getting that much power directly into the batteries. Now, the batteries are putting out their power, and the battery power is what's going through that big rotary joint. And that rotary joint is as big as a car, you know. So, and it's coming through, and now they have DC to DC converters. They go from 160 to 120. And that eventually gets changed to AC. So, and that 30 volts is the, you know, it's usually a lot of the stuff on board the Russian side, but the American side is 120, you know, as they're coming in. So they need some kind of conversion to help the Russians to get down to 30. And if all the solar panels were out, the Russians could actually help out the American side too. They'd have to have some kind of up converters to get. But the interesting things are these batteries. You know, each one of these, let's say, 400-pound batteries that are up there now, they're taking out and they're going to do away with. They're going to take 12 out and they're going to replace them with 6. Out of the 12 that they take out, 9 are going to be put onto the pallet that goes back onto this cargo Japanese HTV cargo craft, which is going to burn up over the Pacific. Let me drop it. You know, I'm just amazed with these things because I was reading about the hydrogen, these nickel hydrogen batteries to make these things. They're charged. Each canister has dozens and dozens of cells inside this one battery, and each cell has a steel canister that's welded, and it's pressurized with 1,200 psi of hydrogen inside of this thing. And this constantly goes down in pressure and then back up in pressure, down in pressure and up in pressure, depending on whether it's charging or discharging. I'm not surprised how common these things are. They're used on other satellites. That I found amazing. So they're all 1.5 cell, so, I think it's 1.5 1.55 open circuit, 1.25 with a load on it, and they're, naturally they were all in series parallel to the belt.